This is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, YouTube tries to rein in offensive content, but isn't making many friends. Then, the man who invented the DeLorean car was a brilliant engineer, but also was caught in a drug sting. A new docudrama tries to find his true character.
His children saw him as one man, his wife as another, his business associates another man. You know, he was neither hero and villain. And I think it would be unfair to paint him with one brush.
And the series Baskets is back. We hear from stars Zach Galifianakis and Louis Anderson. All that coming up on The Frame from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC.
KPCC podcasts are supported by HBO, presenting Game of Thrones. Critics have hailed the final season as TV's greatest show of all time and era-defining, Emmy-eligible for Outstanding Drama Series and all other categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. At yesterday's Code Conference, YouTube CEO Susan Wojcicki apologized to the LGBT community. Her comments came in response to racist and homophobic attacks on YouTube aimed at a journalist from Vox.com, but Wojcicki defended YouTube's handling of the incident. Ina Fried is the chief technology correspondent at Axios. She was at the conference, and she filled me in on what Wojcicki shared with the audience.
She started out with this apology and saying, I know a lot of people were hurt, but then the next words out of her mouth were, you know, we looked at it, we checked, and it didn't violate our policies, and we did the right thing. So it wasn't, from my perspective, an apology for their actions. And so I confronted her in the question and answer period, and I said, are you sorry people were offended, or are you apologizing for any specific action? And
YouTube has always been a home of so many LGBTQ creators, and that's why it was so emotional.
She hemmed and hawed a bit, and I think, you know, bottom line is she feels like Google actually followed its policies.
It feels like YouTube has a couple of options here. One is to block or remove content. Another is to demonetize content. How do those two play off against each other, and are there other possible solutions?
Sure, there's two, and I'd throw in a third. So those two are certainly two of the main options. So they can take a video down, and that's the strongest action, and that's really for when a video clearly crosses their lines of what their policies are. Demonetizing, you know, they have a tremendous amount of flexibility here. Basically, that means they won't serve ads and share revenue against it. And there's two reasons they might do this. One is to send a signal to the content creator that they don't approve of the content. But the other is that's where they make their money, and advertisers don't want to be associated in general, even with controversial content most of the time, but certainly not with offensive content. So I think that's a practical step that they will take. The third, and this is probably the most fruitful area for growth, is in recommendations. So what are they pushing people towards? And I think people underestimate the power of that. I think I've heard 70% of YouTube views come from what's recommended, not from what people initially start on. So that's the area, I think, where all of the platforms, including and especially YouTube, have the most area to improve. Twitter's executives, who were also at Code, talked a fair amount about this. So even if they support free speech and support letting more content than some people would like live on the platform, they certainly don't have to amplify it.
In Politico, the columnist Jack Schaefer wrote, I'm quoting him now, YouTube really is a cesspit, and Google's efforts to rein it in are often ham-handed, but it's also a colossally important public square and an underappreciated miracle of the internet. There's good reason to keep its freewheeling spirit alive, as unpleasant as that may feel this week. What is your response to that take, the whole public square argument that all voices need to be heard so that they can be challenged?
I mean, I think there is merit to that. I think you still have, you know, fire in a crowded theater sort of exceptions. But I also, again, I think too often we view this as black and white, and we're really losing the power of the internet when we do that. Again, you could let a video live or let a comment live on Twitter, but if you don't recommend it in any way, very few people will actually see it. And I think the platforms are really just awakening to this power that they have. And the fact that how much you amplify that content is a huge factor in how widely it spreads. And so the public square means, you know, I can stand in the middle of the street and yell whatever I want. And that's true. I live in downtown San Francisco, and, you know, there's people at the BART station yelling religious propaganda, but I don't have to amplify that. I don't have to say, hey, come to 24th Street Mission BART and listen to this. And that's basically what the platforms have been doing for years, is attracting attention to it. So that's one thing to be a public square, and it's another thing to attract others and say, hey, come look at what's over here.
Recent estimates suggest that there are about 500 hours of new video content that are uploaded on YouTube every minute. So the question is, how much can an algorithm spot what's offensive, and how much are human eyes and ears necessary to police that?
I think you get at the problem. I mean, it's a scale problem, so you're going to have to use algorithms for a lot of it. I think the important thing is to have the humans in the right places, which is setting the policies in the first place and reviewing the questions about those policies. And when I interviewed Sundar Pichai for Axios on HBO, the Google CEO, you know, he talked about right now video, they don't have the kinds of tools and signals that they do in search. If you search for something, you get a pretty accurate, good, high quality result. That's not the case with video. You search for a topic and you might get a great video, you might get, you know, misinformation, you might get conspiracy theories, although they're working hard on that.
And the other issue, it seems to be, that in trying to curtail things like neo-Nazi hate speech on YouTube and ban Holocaust deniers, the company has removed videos from history teachers talking about Adolf Hitler. And I think the same has happened with positive LGBTQ content, that it's going down because it's caught by some algorithm. So what is the challenge in separating what is acceptable from what isn't if you're trying to be a good police officer?
So those are definitely two different challenges and two important challenges for YouTube. The second one first is a newer one with their new policies where you're not allowed to post information about where that propagates the idea that one group is better than another. It is true, and they actually warned this would happen, that some people educating about the Holocaust are actually going to initially find themselves, I think they'll find themselves very quickly reinstated, or that's the hope. The second issue you get is a more challenging one for the industry, which is that people talking about LGBTQ issues tend to get flagged or banned as, you know, risky or adult content, even if they're just talking not sexually, just about identity. And the people who attack LGBTQ tend to get protected as free speech and just expressing an opinion. I brought this up with Twitter because Twitter has a real problem in this area where oftentimes the people who are being harassed, women, people of color, LGBTQ people, are the ones that find themselves getting banned for either defending themselves or pointing out how they're being harassed, and the harassers flourish. And I saw somebody put it really well last night. The idea that, you know, people talk about free speech all the time, but part of free speech is I feel like I'll be free enough not to be harassed.
Ina Fried is the chief technology correspondent at Axios. Ina, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, John.
Coming up next on The Frame, the docudrama Framing John DeLorean.
KPCC podcasts are supported by HBO, presenting Sharp Objects, based on the best-selling novel by Gillian Flynn. The story focuses on Camille Preaker, a journalist with a history of psychiatric issues who returns to her rural hometown to cover the apparent murders of two preteen girls. The limited series was hailed by critics as exquisite, hauntingly compelling, and a true masterpiece. Emmy eligible for Outstanding Limited Series and all other categories. Visit hbo.com/FYC for more on Sharp Objects.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. The spectacular rise and fall of John DeLorean seems tailor-made for a Hollywood film. In the 1950s and 60s, he made his name at General Motors as an engineering maverick. He was featured in magazines, he dated supermodels, he even had plastic surgery to enlarge his chin. When he left GM to found the DeLorean Motor Company, his vision for the future of cars, with those winged doors that opened up, captured a lot of notice, including from Back to the Future filmmaker Robert Zemeckis.
Are you telling me that you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
But in 1982, in a desperate effort to keep his business afloat, DeLorean fell for an FBI sting. He was attempting to traffic cocaine. In the subsequent trial, he was acquitted, but his career never recovered. He died in 2005 alone and destitute. So why haven't any of the many planned feature films about DeLorean ever been made? Directors Don Argut and Sheena Joyce try to explain that in their new docudrama, Framing John DeLorean.
John is really hard to crack. He did great things. He had amazing highs and lows. He has all the benchmarks that make a great biopic in his life. But he was also very flat He was never super emotional, certainly all of the footage that we've seen. Even in the worst of times, he's unflappable. He's cool.
All right, the involvement with cocaine. Talk about that. Why did it happen? You say it
was entrapment. Well, it's a peculiar thing because, you know, in my life, I have never, even to this day, with the exception of that one suitcase they threw in front of me, and I'm not even sure what that was, but I've never ever seen cocaine, touched cocaine, used cocaine, or been in the presence of anybody.
And so we took this concept of these unproduced projects and decided to use that as a device in our film to see if we could, you know, in a sense, crack the code by talking about how no one has cracked the code yet.
And yet, cracking the code on the documentary had its own challenges, right? That you picked up this project about 10 years ago, and it's only now kind of coming together. So what were the obstacles for the documentary?
We were always looking for a way in to tell the story. And I think once we settled on the idea of using the, kind of failed attempts at making the film, that opened up a whole new kind of creative possibility for us with the idea of using actors and reenactments. And then obviously, in addition to that, we filmed the making of those reenactments to give another layer of insight into John's character.
You draw a straight line up the brow, overlaps the corner.
Well, I think it's going to come in a little bit.
It's going to come over?
Yeah.
There are three different elements to your documentary. One is the traditional documentary where you have people that you talk to on camera, archival footage, and then you have the reenactments of what happened. And then you go to the other step, which is that you have Alec Baldwin kind of getting into character, actually putting on the makeup to play John DeLorean.
When you start to play him, you go, no, 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 no. He's not guilty of anything. In fact, it's the opposite. He's a hero in his mind. He's a hero. And you have to play that.
So as you're watching Alec Baldwin put on the makeup with his Saturday Night Live makeup team, what is going through your head as he's transforming himself into John DeLorean?
We were having these great conversations with Alec leading up to filming. He's so smart and thoughtful and would ask such great questions.
We shoot him for your purposes over the arc of how many years?
Mostly early 70s to early 80s.
Right, there's a spread, and he ages during that time.
Yeah, that's right.
And I want to see how his behavior ages. I need to see clips that are
talking about how the conversations that were happening off screen were sometimes, you know, just as illuminating as a talking head interview would have been.
We really wanted to make sure that, first and foremost, he could pull the look off. There was a great moment, and they were putting all the prosthetics on for the first time, the chin and the nose of that iconic gray hair. And once he put it on and looked in the mirror for the first time, there was a moment, I think, of all of us in the room collectively saying, well, oh my God, like, it's incredible. He looks amazing.
People who know John DeLorean know not only about the car, but about the sting. And this is a clip of the day that the FBI and the DEA arrange the deal to entrap, as it turns out, John DeLorean.
And the government picked him up, took him to a hotel room, opened a bottle of champagne, toasted to their success. And one of the agents went to the closet, brought out the suitcase of cocaine and opened it up.
Between this and the other half, it's gonna generate about four and a half mil.
This is better than gold. Gold weighs more than that, for God's sakes.
That's when DeLorean said, this is like gold, this is better than gold.
Better than gold. Gold weighs more than that, for God's sakes.
Classic line on that tape.
So during this sequence, you have reenacted moments, you have actual surveillance tape, you have commentary. In terms of putting so many different pieces together, how does that scene work in your minds, and why was it essential to have so many different things going on in just a couple of seconds of the film?
I think for us, it provided a way to weave the straight kind of talking head documentary elements and the narrative elements together in a more creative or seamless way.
They put John in a situation which is basically, a glorified movie set. You know, he's on camera. They're trying to get him to say, be and act a certain way so they can get him on camera so that they could use it against him later.
Undercover agents dressed as other people.
Right. I think it's this kind of pivotal moment. And at that point, you don't know what's real, what's not real. And that was really how we wanted that to come across.
As I hear you talking about the way you made the film, I can't help but think about the way seismologists find the epicenter of an earthquake, and that is they get three data points, and where those lines intersect is an approximation of the epicenter, and it feels like you have three data points as well. And where those three lines intersect, I guess, is maybe an approximation of who John DeLorean is, because even though you're close, you may not really exactly know who he was and what he was.
Yeah, I'm going to change my business card to a seismologist.
But to your point, I think we did as good a job as anyone can do getting to the heart of that man. And, you know, the title of the film, Framing John DeLorean, has more to do with the frames through which we view people than anything else. You know, his children saw him as, you know, one man, his wife as another, his business associates, another man. You know, he was neither hero and villain, you know, and I think it would be unfair to paint him with one brush.
We're talking with Don Argott and Sheena Joyce. They're the directors of the documentary Framing John DeLorean. John was married a number of times. One of his wives was a woman named Christina Farrar. She's a model. She's a mom. She sticks with DeLorean throughout his trial, but leaves him a couple of days after the acquittal. And her story is one that really kind of unfolds in the media.
I was at the top of my modeling profession. I've been doing it for 20 years. The last 15 years I've been at the very top of it, commanding top money. And this is July, and since January I've had one booking and I've made $105. No one will have anything to do with me or my name. Not at all.
And she is performed through the reenactments by the actor Moreno Baccarin. I'm curious about what you wanted to get right about Christina Farrar and why she's important to the story.
I think she's important to the story because she's the glue that held that family together while they were going through everything, and the sacrifices that she had to make to get her husband and kids through that time. Christina has been a wonderful friend to the film. You know, she didn't want to be on camera, but she spoke to Alec. She spoke to Marina. Marina's performance was informed by a lot of her conversations with Christina. And I think it shouldn't be taken for granted that this is a woman who really was at the top of her game. She was on the cover of every top magazine. She was, you know, a supermodel before we even called them supermodels. And she had to really give that all up because of John's decisions and try and keep her family together. And then I think, you know, she may be judged harshly by some people for leaving John after the trial, but I think she did what she had to do to keep her kids safe and together.
Well, let's hear from Zach DeLorean, his son, and what he says to you in your documentary.
I mean, it's got all the good in it. It's got cocaine, it's got hot chicks, it's got sports cars, it's got war-torn, you know, bombed-out buildings overseas. It's got Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, the war on drugs. But my fear with Hollywood is they're going to end it with him coming out of the courthouse with Christina. While that coming out of the courthouse, you know, ticker tape parade is real, look at what it cost him.
Zach's really talking about his concern about what Hollywood might or might not do in telling his story, but both Zach and his sister, Catherine, speak very honestly about their father, and they obviously have very conflicted and complicated feelings. What did having his kids in your film bring to the story?
If the film had stopped with his success on the courthouse steps, you wouldn't have seen what happened with the rest of his life and the kind of collateral damage that people associated with him suffered because of his actions. And I think that is, you know, no clearer in anyone other than Zach, especially. He's still very, very raw about that time in his life.
The idea that a Hollywood film would want to end with some kind of triumphant ending, although that, as Zach says, that would be great, that's really not the story. And I think the film, in a way, once you see the film, we actually honor Zach's ending of how he wanted to see his father kind of remembered.
Don Argott and Sheena Joyce are the directors of Framing John DeLorean. Don and Sheena, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Framing John DeLorean is in theaters starting June 14th. Coming up, Baskets is back. We talk with two of the series stars. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. The FX series Baskets returns this week for its fourth season. The show stars its co-creator, Zach Galifianakis. He plays the identical twins, Dale and Chip Baskets. Chip is the lead. He's a struggling artist type who lives with his mother. In 2017, I spoke with Galifianakis about his idea for this offbeat comedy.
I wanted it to be kind of an innocent show a little bit where it wasn't too vulgar. And I think that I wanted the lead character to not talk so much. And I wanted there to be old-fashioned physical comedy. And I wanted to set it in the world of rodeo clowns. Right out of the gate, a terrible idea, all of it. But we just tonally wanted to make it a little bit different enough because I think comedies have kind of gotten very one note. And this isn't really even I wouldn't even call it too much of just a straight comedy. We call it a slapstick drama on set.
Let me ask you a little bit more about the casting, because outside of, you know, people like Louis Anderson, the nature of the casting feels essentially like you're just grabbing people off the streets. And I mean that, but I mean that as a compliment.
How could I take it any other way?
I mean,
how could I take it any other way but a compliment?
There is a naturalism. Even the person who's working the front desk at the Reagan Museum, it just feels like that person is probably, when she's not on Baskets, working the front desk at the Reagan Museum.
She works at that actress actually worked at the Ron Reagan Jr. Library. That's where we got her from. Yes, authenticity is everything. I mean, you look at TV sometimes, and it's very glossy and very fast-paced, and I think, I don't know any of those kind of people. I know more people like that are on Baskets than I do on, you know, these slicker shows.
One of the central themes of the show is that Chip believes he is called to be an artist, and he wants to be an elite clown, and he can't figure out how he can do it.
Well, part of it is, okay, so Chip is not a very good artist. He really loves that world and wants to be accepted in that world. But what he's looking for is community. When you move to another city and you're trying to pursue things that are away from your family, if it's stand-up or if it's being an actor or whatever it could be, you move to a town full of strangers and you start finding your community. And I think Chip's character, when he was in France, he was accepted by outsiders because he himself was an outsider, even though he's not a great clown. But he was weird enough for the artist to take him in, and that he finally found his community. And I was like, this is what he's looking for. And then that's pulled away from him because he's rejected by, you know, his wife, his French wife, and that whole world. So he's kind of looking for a new community, and it may be that he's forced to make that community his family.
A key member of that family is Chip's mom, Christine.
What's that?
It's marijuana, madame. We will smoke it outside.
Oh, no. Is that the same as grass?
Yes.
Do you mind if I give it a try?
What?
Sure, yeah.
Wait a second, yeah. Mom. No.
What?
You're weird enough. Mom, don't do that.
I don't take orders from you anymore, Chip. I'm out of the rodeo.
The part of Christine Baskets, the mother of Zach Galifianakis' characters, is played by comedian Louis Anderson. In 2016, we talked about how he got into the role.
It was a work in progress all the way through. Like, I had an idea of who I would play as Christine, because I've been doing my mom in my act for 30-odd years. So, you know, I would have a little bit of an affected voice, like, now, Louie, you know, that type of a thing. But not cartoony, just, you know, really real. And then when the scripts came and the family got developed, I developed Christine, I think, just by reading those scripts in that sense. You know how this is now me,
right,
playing a woman. More interestingly, this is me playing Zach's mother, or the character Chip's mother.
How would you describe the similarities or differences between Christine and your own mother? And how did your own mother influence this part?
Christine's a little more, she's a little rougher around the edges than my mom, and not as sweet, sweet, sweet as my mom was. You know, Christine you know, has had some big hardships in her life, you know, with losing her husband and having these kids that, you know, are somewhat of a disappointment to her, where she had to adopt other children who she thought would be a much better example of what twins should be. And I think, you know, her, the trauma that she suffered and the trauma she suffered with her mother plays a definite role in the development of the character.
So what does Christine think of Chip's desire to be a clown? And what, how would you describe the relationship kind of professionally, the stage mom who does or does not believe in her son's ambitions?
Well, I think she has high hopes, but they're dashed on a continuous basis. And she's maybe down in the dumps when it's just her alone, but in front of others, she puts on a brave face, and God help you if you try to take a shot at her son.
She's very protective.
She'll let you have it.
And we'll close out today with this. The band Radiohead has a novel way to deal with hackers, which is basically share what they stole. Some 18 hours of demos and outtakes made around the band's landmark album OK Computer in 1997 were apparently hacked from Radiohead guitarist Tom York. The thieves demanded a $150,000 ransom. But Radiohead instead made the stolen material available. You can buy the recordings for about $23, with the proceeds going to the environmental charity Extinction Rebellion. And that is it for today. From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, I'm John Horn. We're back here tomorrow.